Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, Jamal Mahoub, Hamid Khalafala and Adel Suleiman discuss the current crisis in Sudan, a conflict which has resulted in severe humanitarian disaster, with over 14,000 fatalities and millions displaced. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, our panel examines the complexities of the issue, efforts to negotiate peace, and how much needed relief can be found for the affected population.
Thank you for coming on this session about Sudan, which is titled The Forgotten Crisis. So the fact that you're here means you've already remembered it. So that's great. And I've got two great people here next to me. There's Hamid Khalafala, who is a writer and researcher from Manchester. He grew up in Sudan. And we've got Jamal Mahoub, who's come all the way from Amsterdam. And he's also a novelist and writer. So we're just going to kick it straight off with Jamal, who's going to maybe just give us a quick summary of the conflict, which isn't easy to do, and the origins. So how did we get here?
Okay, well, thank you and welcome. And it's very difficult to know where to start. I mean, it's the thing that I find most frustrating about the coverage that we see in the media about what's happening in Sudan is this sort of simplistic view that it's simply two generals who've just taken it into their own hands to decide to start this conflict between themselves and in the process are busy destroying the country. And of course, the truth is a lot more complicated than that. Sudan is a much more complicated story to begin with. I've spent, 30 years or so writing about Sudan. I grew up there, and I think that I was very much connected with the older generation of Sudanese who came out of independence, the early days of independence, my father's generation, and where there was a great deal of optimism about what Sudan could become. Sudan has great potential, and at moments in time, we've seen this potential. When I was growing up, it was supposed to become the breadbasket of Africa. It has great land resources and water resources and natural minerals and so forth. At the moment, gold, of course. So all of this was, for a very long time, there was a feeling that Sudan simply had to find its own feet and, achieve its full potential. And yet, along the road, continually, there have been political setbacks. And the political setbacks have more often than not involved the overthrow of civilian government by military officers. And if you look back, even 2 years after independence, you had a military intervention and then you had further down the line, you had several more. When I was growing up in Khartoum, the idea of a coup was not unusual. We would wake up in the morning and there would be cannons in the distance, and then there would be, martial music being played on Radio Omdurman, and you would get 2 or 3 days off school, and then, you would go back and everything would kind of return to normal. And in the process of all this sort of backwards and forwards, there was in Sudan has one of the oldest trade union movements. It has one of the strongest histories of education. Khartoum University is one of the oldest in Africa. People in Sudan have great respect for education and learning, and Manchester University, but universities all over this country, or the Great Britain, have a long record of Sudanese coming, becoming educated and going home to try and help Sudan. So, Sudan has had many attempts at trying to create the kind of stability that's needed for the country to thrive. And unfortunately, time and again, we've had this situation. And if you look back to, for example, Nimeiri started out as a socialist, and gradually as time went on, he became more and more moved towards paranoid, religious sectarianism. And you gradually see in a process whereby the idea of a political stance, a political position, became more and more difficult, becomes more and more, you can't get away from the idea of your tribal affiliations, which part of the country you come from, which part of who your family are, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea of a pure expression of what are your political views, what do you think is best for the country, this became increasingly, as time went by, more and more difficult. By the time you arrive at the coup of 1989, which brought in Omar al-Bashir, you had a situation in which previous regimes or governments had tried going to the left with socialism. They'd tried moving closer to the capitalist model later on. And what they arrived at in 1989 was the idea that Islam, or a very specific version of Islam, was going to save the country and bring the country together. And this was the brainchild of Hassan al-Turabi, who was the man, the theological mind behind Omar al-Bashir. Omar al-Bashir was a very simple man, uneducated, military officer. He had no real idea what he was doing, except that he wanted to take control. And Turabi had this idea. And for 10 years, you saw in Sudan one of the worst periods of repression in Sudanese history. People were arrested, they were tortured, they disappeared into what we used to call ghost houses. They went abroad, millions of people went abroad. At a certain point, you had Sudanese living all over the world, not just the classical places where they used to go, where they had connections like Britain or Europe or America, Canada, but Korea, Japan, new places, Australia, places that were never on the map of the Sudanese before. And you had a generation of Sudanese who then grew up and have brought their families up outside Sudan. And with gradually this sort of feeling of, you know, is it going to be at all possible to come back? Now, this experiment with Islam came to an end after 10 years when a certain pragmatism came in and Bashir decided that for the sake of good business, you needed to slow this thing down. And so it became more about consolidating Bashir's position in an economic, political, military way, in a similar way to what you saw in Egypt, where the military starts, the people around the Mubarak and then Sisi really took control of what was going on. And something similar was going on in Sudan. And gradually, political opposition became impossible. Either you joined in or you were excluded. You were out, you know? So political, the whole idea, again, of expressing yourself politically, being able to have a debate politically, what is best for the country, this all became simply washed out, you know? And you ended up with a situation in which it became very, very volatile. What Bashir did, which is an old tactic, was he broke down the armed forces into smaller militia groups, with the idea that if you have all of these groups who are afraid of each other, none of them will be able to get together to overthrow you. And one of these groups came out of Darfur and was the Janjaweed, which then became officially incorporated as or transformed into the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces. And these people were the ones that became closest, Hemeti became closest to Bashir. And that was his position. And then you arrive at this situation where we are now, which is where you have almost, I'm skipping over the revolution because that was obviously a throwback to the old Sudan where people have believed in civilian rule, where people believed that they could express themselves and they believed that there was a way in which Sudan could grow into what it was everybody had hoped it would since independence in 1956. Let's skip briefly over that. We'll come back to it for sure. But what you're then left with is this completely leached out political surface, with people who held grudges because they had been imprisoned, they had lost family members, etc., etc. And you end up with this situation in which Hemeti is meant to be incorporated into the National Army, and he refuses to do so. At the same time, while this is happening, you know, there's a lot going on the outside. There is money, there is gold, there are people, outside players who are getting involved, there are RSF forces that are being sent to Yemen, there are all kinds of things going on, which are making Hemeti believe now is his time, now is his moment. The most strange thing about Hemeti is nothing that he does really seems to suggest, and this is in contrast to many of the other people that we've seen in over the years in Sudan. He gives no indication that he actually really has a plan for what ruling Sudan. What he's done so far is simply destructive. There's nothing there that seems constructive in any way. So it's very difficult to understand somebody like that. But we now seem to be in a situation where it's not about Sudan. It's not about Sudan's future. It's about the individual personal interests of these people in this, starting with Hemeti, but who see that there is a great deal of money and power to be made in this game that we call politics.
Thank you for running us through that. We could keep going.
Sorry, I'm sorry.
I appreciate you skipping us through that massive history. And my dad's Sudanese, and I remember him growing up telling me the first female lawmaker in Africa was in Sudan, and it was this great progressive memory for him.
Well, women, but the women's movement in Sudan was very well known all throughout the Middle East and was often referred to as being one of the earliest and one of the strongest feminist movements.
Yeah. It's interesting. And you touched on foreign players there, which I think Hamid can take us through. So, it's not just these two men who are warring in Sudan and everybody else is kind of being dragged along. There are some real foreign interventions into this conflict. So do you want to maybe explain those?
Sure. And thank you, everyone, for coming today. I think when speaking about foreign interventions, there's two sides to it. One side is the international community. And when I say the international community, I mean no matter how fluid these terms are, but Western or global North, allegedly democratic countries that also allegedly have respect and values, human rights and democracy and equality and so on. And then the other regional actors, that's the other side, the other regional actors who have direct interests, as Jamal mentioned, gold and land and so on. So on the international community side, I will make two points to show how they're complicit and also how they have leverage and have power to make the war end, but they're not using it. The first one, in terms of complicity, as Jamal mentioned, in 2018, 2019, there was a historic revolution led by youth and a very broad grassroots movement that again reignited this hope of what Sudan could be. And, there were plans, there were clear things that were indicating that, we're going that way. But on the international community side, there was a lot of anxiety and paranoia about the democratic transition in Sudan and the messiness of it. And, democratic transitions are inherently messy. This is how the process is supposed to be. There was a lot of anxiety about that. And, we can't risk the security of the region, the Sahel, the Horn of Africa, East Africa, Northern Africa, migration, people going into Europe and the Mediterranean and so on. So the international community compromised democracy and prioritized stability and security. And in that sense, they pushed civilians to believe in a power-sharing agreement with military factions. Obviously, there are political elites who were more than happy to sign the deal and tie their interests with the military factions, which was the Sudanese Armed Forces and also the Rapid Support Forces, the new name for the Janjaweed that came out of the Darfur 2003 war. So that power-sharing agreement was inevitably going to fail because you have, two sides who don't see eye to eye, civilians who want democratic civilian rule and a military that's only interested in maintaining their interests. And then after the coup in 2021, when the military, as people expected and as people were protesting on a weekly basis against that, this power-sharing agreement and the way it was working, the military in 2021 ousted the civilian side of the government and took on full control. People continued to protest against that, risking their lives on a weekly basis. Hundreds were killed, but the international community was still adamant that you need to talk to the military, you need to trust the military. These people are to be trusted. Now, after the war erupted, they're kind of saying, well, maybe we were wrong in, working with the military and trusting these people. Meanwhile, people were dying every week, protesting against that and telling them the military is not to be trusted. So this is how the international community is very much involved in what's happening.
International community. Shall we name names? What countries are we talking about? The UAE, Egypt, the UK, America?
The UK, the US, the European Union. Like I said, the regional Emiratis, for instance, the United Arab Emirates, are directly fueling the war. They are paying the Arab Support Forces. They are sending them arms and so on. That is a direct kind of intervention, but also, the United Arab Emirates never claimed to be interested in democracy and human rights and so on. It's the UK, the US, the European Union who are keep on saying that this is what they, value and this is what they preach. However, they were the ones who pushed for this alliance with the military, and now the only result that we got was the ongoing war. The other side of to show how they are able to make things stop is that obviously, like you said, I grew up in Sudan and I only left after the war, and I stayed my family and I we stayed for a month during the first month of the war, from 15th of April to mid-May. And during that period, the international community were able to kind of make the warring factions sign a couple of ceasefire agreements in Jeddah. Obviously, none of the warring factions honored these agreements. It was all, you know, ink on paper and so on, except for a few hours on a couple of days when the international community, namely the US and the UN, were evacuating their citizens and employees in Khartoum. There were hours of ceasefire. So it shows you if they wanted to use that leverage to provide protection to their citizens, they were able to do it. But for these people, it did not matter that much. So these 2 points, just to put into perspective, you know, what the international community, namely the Western countries, democratic countries, are involved in what's happening and so on. And ever since then, the response to what's going on in Sudan has been quite fragmented. There's no coordination between different actors who are providing different mediation initiatives. It has all been generally lackluster, and, you know, there's no energy and real effort put into the process, although, like I said, there is leverage that they have. Obviously, one of the issues is that a lot of the Western countries, governments like the US and the UK and European Union countries as well, is that they have been outsourcing their diplomacy in the region to Emirates, to Saudi, to Israel. And now these powers have grown and are now, you know, complicit or directly intervening in different conflicts in the region and so on. And they don't want to compromise that relationship because maybe the lives that are dying do not matter enough for them to compromise these relationships. So yes, there is a lot that the international community could do to make the war stop, but it's not being done.
Right, that's a complicated web, isn't it, of players. Jamal, maybe you could touch on America, which kind of toys with Sudan. It picks it up and it drops it. I mean, Sudan has huge resources and potential bases, etc. I was thinking about when Trump, in exchange for them recognizing Israel, took them off the sanctions list. I mean, if anyone here has ever been to Sudan, you can't get anything Western, right? There's no Western brands. It's kind of like Cuba. You can't get money out. There's no ATMs. So people were desperate to get off this list, and he gave them that. And then we have Joe Biden, who's running on this platform of democracy, and he's been criticized for not supporting democracy in Africa in particular. So what role does America play?
Well, I mean, not just America. I mean, America plays a big role because it's a large, important player. But I mean, as Hamid said, I mean, it's just the entire Western attitude is remarkable. I mean, it's very difficult to understand. The European Union was paying the RSF as a kind of border control to stop migrants coming across the Sahara and to the Mediterranean. I mean, all of their policies seem to be completely lackluster, short-sighted. I mean, the American, I can't remember the name of the American envoy, but they're all hopeless. They seem to have no idea what they're talking about. They have no grasp of the situation. And it's difficult to understand why. I mean, I understand that everybody has, there are big problems and so on. And, you know, somebody like Trump, I mean, it seems kind of random. I mean, I can't really say that, but we'll see now when he gets elected a second time what he does. But, you know, these decisions all seem to be kind of random. Nobody has any real idea. Nobody wants to invest time and money. And it's true that over years, Britain in particular, but a lot of the European countries scaled down their presence and their interactions with Sudan. And that simply means that you no longer have the influence that you once had. And I think that this is part of this overall view in Europe you want to make reduce the size of government, the same in America, reduce the size of government and save money in the short term. But actually, you're creating problems for yourself and for the world in the long term. If this crisis in Sudan now continues, we're talking about famine on a major scale. We're talking about genocide in Darfur. We're talking about the breakup of the country, very possibly splitting now into the West and the East and into the sort of the Southeast. You've got the conflict has already reached across the Sahel belt. You've got now sort of a conflict going from the Red Sea coast, from Eritrea across all the way through. And, you know, this is creating a catastrophe for millions of people. You can't simply walk away and then wait until the catastrophe actually happens and people are actually dying on your television screens before you say, oh, well, what should we have done? You know, I mean, this is it's absurd. But that's the situation. And Sudan is a typical example. I mean, even if you go back into history, Sudan for the British was never really an interest. If you go back to the time of when it was a condominium, which was ruled jointly between Egypt and Britain, the interest in Sudan was just marginal. What was important for the British was the Nile providing water for the much more important possession, which was Egypt. But actually, actual interest in Sudan never had, for example, the idea of settlers like you had in Kenya, people who came to grow crops and so forth. So that relationship was never formed. But the interest in what's going on in Sudan was never there. It was always like, okay, we don't really know. As Gordon said, you know, nobody knows what to do with Sudan. And this is back in, you know, 1898, 1896. So it's always been in this sort of peripheral place where people, when you have a crisis like you had in Darfur in 2003, 2005, and suddenly you had celebrities getting involved. So you had, you know, Mia Farrow and George Clooney and, you know, and they were all involved for their own, you know, perhaps, you know, out of the goodness of their hearts. But once the spotlight moves on, then everybody moves away. The whole same with South Sudan. The secession of South Sudan was an absolute catastrophe for Sudan altogether. 80% of the oil in Sudan was in the south. And there was, you know, Khartoum was the regime, Bashir's regime was completely indifferent. They thought that they could manage better without all these southerners. There was a great deal of racism involved. But I was there and I saw how so many displaced southern Sudanese who'd been living in Khartoum and had become basically, were speaking Arabic and had become basically northern, you know, northerners or, you know, citizens of Sudan, of Khartoum at least, were had to get their possessions, get on these trucks, be taken down to a country that for many of the young kids, they knew nothing about, you know? And South Sudan was launched as being the next success story. You know, it was going to be, and within a very short period of time, they were calling it Nigeria Mark II for the level of corruption. Catastrophe, outside influence is, outside players, you really, it's shameful that they behave in this way because it's irresponsible and it ultimately creates more problems down the road and they don't seem to be able to learn the lesson.
It's really sad. Mohammed, maybe you could tell us, you were there during the war and you just touched on the massive, I think it's the world's biggest refugee crisis. What's day-to-day life like for people who are still in Sudan? I mean, I hear reports of no electricity, no food, you have to pay hundreds of dollars to try and get on a bus to Egypt or, you know, what's it like?
There's a war economy going on at full scale where all prices have spiked and everything costs at least 10 times what it used to cost. But then there's also the dangers of, you know, living in the crossfire and people facing displacements for the third, fourth time in the course of a year. Like, I know people who've been displaced for 5 times so far. They move from one place to the other, thinking that this is a safe place. Then the conflict grows and goes into that place. Then they move to the next place. And all of this is within Sudan because, you know, myself and my family and others are privileged enough to be able to afford leaving the country through these very expensive roads and also very unsafe in many ways. Then the vast majority cannot afford this, cannot leave. So all of this displacement moving around from one place to another is within the country, searching for safety, but that is obviously not available anywhere in the country. Then obviously living in very dire humanitarian, you know, situations. 80% of Sudan's health facilities are either not operating anymore or inaccessible because you can't move from one place to the other. So the national healthcare system has entirely collapsed. Massive food shortages, famine, at least 5 million people are living in famine. Meanwhile, obviously the United Nations are very cautious to call it a famine because it kind of requires a lot of actions from their side that they're not prepared to take, and they don't have the money to pay for. So they're trying to move around the world and saying, you know, the brink of famine, there's a food shortage, food crisis, but they don't want to call it a famine, which people on the ground will tell you that it is famine. So no food, no healthcare support. Obviously, schools have been closed for 15 months now, so children are not going to schools. This is the entire generation that is losing, have already lost more than 1 year of academy of education, and you don't know how long this is going to continue. But what's amazing and what's happening. And the only thing that gives me hope in this madness is the spirit of mutual aid and the power of mutual aid that people are doing, because the international communities, the international humanitarian aid that is being provided to Sudan is less than 40% of what's needed. And even that 40% gets obviously, when it goes through the big aid agencies, machineries and pay salaries and logistics and so on, what actually reaches the ground is even much less. But regardless of that, Sudanese people on the ground through mutual aid by, you know, crowdfunding internally from whatever resources that they have or from the Sudanese diaspora who have been shouldering this entire humanitarian, the funding of the humanitarian response, meanwhile the Sudanese, the international aid agencies are not able to do anything. When you see these stories and what people are doing, communal, like communal kitchens and, you know, soup kitchens and entertainment spaces for children so that they could slightly deal with some of the traumas that they're living through and they come and play and to have a couple of hours of, you know, a bit of normalcy before they go back to home and spend the night under the sounds of, you know, gunfire around and so on. So what's happening on the ground is quite remarkable. It's the only thing that gives me hope. And there is some light in the way people come together and support each other, but also the way mutual aid is being used as an act of political participation to keep, you know, the resistance movement alive and thriving. So whatever resources that the community manages to bring and so on, everyone in the community gets to decide how it gets spent, who gets what, where does it get stored. And there's accountability mechanisms that are quite amazing. They would, everyone in the neighborhood would have access to the book that shows how much money and donations came in, where was it spent and so on. Yet you would have international organizations asking them, if you want us to give you money for to this mutual aid group or whatever, you have to follow our reporting mechanisms and write these, you know, bureaucratic report, go through all these bureaucratic hurdles and write all these reports and all these proposals and so on. Meanwhile, people are literally, you know, living in war and they're asked to get on a computer and type on a report and send it by email when internet is already being cut and used by both warring factions to deprive people from access to the outside world, but also, you know, to not be able to communicate with each other. So that's how it's being used, and in a very consultative bottom-up way that is, you know, again, it's the very colonial way that the international aid works and so on. So yeah, it's a very difficult daily life, but people are managing somehow through supporting each other.
I'm glad that you're a little bit hopeful. I heard stories about women burying their gold and soldiers coming around with metal detectors and taking it, and how difficult the communications are, I think, is another real underreported issue. Okay, we're going to open up to questions now, I think. So maybe we'll start with this lady at the front and then we'll go to you.
You mentioned the Emirates. Can you say anything about those countries and their part in this? Emirates, Saudi Arabia, or et cetera?
Yeah, well, I mean, the Emirates has an interest in supporting the RSF. They seem to think that this will keep the Salafists at bay, that they're afraid that the people who were associated with the old regime will come back again, and they feel that they... I mean, it's a very naive kind of equation that they're using, but they're causing a lot of devastation. I mean, they're flying weapons in through the Central African Republic. You know, it would be a very simple way to try, and somebody should be leaning on them and encouraging them. Not providing weapons is not helping anyone. So it would be very useful if somebody could actually stand up to them and say, you must stop this now. But nobody seems to be willing to do that. And that's really a shame. I mean, these outside players are having a terrible influence on this. And somebody should be, and they are all partners with what's going on in the rest of the world, you know? They all want, the Emirates in particular, wants recognition as being, you know, a decent, moral, upstanding leader in the world, so in the region at least. So it seems to me that's a logical way to go, would be to stop them.
This gentleman here.
Do you believe the military and political, the politicians, the elite in Sudan are essentially just pawns for the global players? Essentially, when I'm talking about global players, talking about really the US and the UK, the frameworks which are being put forward even before the war and even during the war, frameworks are being put forward to solve the problems. But essentially, there are frameworks which serve the interests of the UK and the US. And what underpins these frameworks are ideas which have been peddled by the West, such as democracy, human rights, women's rights, children's rights, and so forth. And we found, after what happened in Gaza, that the only interest that the West really worship is the material. It's not the ethical, it's not the moral, it's not the human, it's not the spiritual, it's just that. So don't you feel that the problem is much, much more deeper, and it's revolved around these colonial powers? Thank you.
There's definitely the interest of, let's say, the US and the UK, for instance. But I think it's not only that they're interested in, you know, material things in Sudan, but I think what they're interested in, the way they see Sudan, is that it has to be stable, and, you know, and they have to they have to prioritize stability, and whoever would provide that stability, they would be more than happy to work with. The same way they were happy to work with the regime of the Bashir for so many years, until he was not able to maintain the political marketplace that he was, you know, maintaining by paying off specific people to keep the country stable and so on. But then when he lost that, they were, okay, not interested in working with him anymore. So I think whoever is able to provide security in the country and promises stability in the region, the international community, US, UK, have no problem working with them, regardless of what they do with human rights, democracy, and so on. So, and that's why their initial calculations was that the military factions would provide that. Now they're thinking, okay, maybe not. So I think the confusion in their response comes from that. They know now, they realize that the military is not going to provide their interests and anymore and so on. But who is the alternative? And the alternative, they are not, you know, they know that they have been trying to support Sudanese civilian elites who could provide that and so on. But they also know that they don't have that much influence and that much power. And the other alternative is supporting the interests and aspirations of the people of Sudan, you know, as expressed by the grassroots movements and so on. But that is, like I said earlier, that is messy, that is unpredictable, you don't know how it goes, and they have no interest in supporting that whatsoever. So yes, I mean, they're happy to compromise values as long as whoever says would provide security and stability in the country would provide it.
I think we should take one on this side, just because, to be fair.
Well, today we have a new foreign secretary, and perhaps you could just give us the headings on your memo to the foreign secretary charged with advancing the interests of this country in a broader sense and the peace of the world. What are the headings in the memo as to what the foreign secretary should now do, leaving aside all the things that should have been done and might have been done, could have been done? Actually, right now, what are the headings?
Well, I mean, I think the main heading is to start to take the situation seriously and to start to really look at what is a durable solution that will allow Sudan to return to civilian rule. And I think there are plenty of experts. The Foreign Office has plenty of people to call on. There are plenty of people in the universities in this country and in America and all over the place who can tell you, you know, what you need to be doing. But the situation that happened after the revolution that displaced Omar al-Bashir was that you had a large number. I mean, this is the problem with democracy, is that it involves allowing people to speak and have opinions and disagree with one another or agree with one another and to make their claims for what they would like to see happen. And, you know, either you allow that process to evolve or you stifle it. I mean, Egypt is a perfect example. Everyone would rather have a Sisi that oppresses people and puts thousands of journalists in jail, people disappearing, whatever, in order to maintain stability in the region. And this is an old story that the Western powers have played in the Middle East for centuries. So what they need to do is take the situation seriously, ask themselves what can be done in order to avert the situation getting worse, because believe you me, it's going to get worse if it doesn't get better and if they don't address it. So I hope that this new foreign secretary will actually take it seriously. But whether he's listening or not, who knows? I think this man...
Oh, sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Bob Fairweather, who I'm not sure I got the right word, who was the rapporteur or something on Sudan for the Foreign Office, was dismissed by the last government, or told he was surplus to requirements, which is exactly echoes what you've just told us. that it's not high on the list of priorities. His view was that Sudan was fixable. Do you share that view? And we've mentioned quite a few countries that have got their fingers in the pie. Have we mentioned Russia yet?
Yeah, I could. I mean, I definitely agree that particularly on the Foreign and Commonwealth Office side, they know what to do. And I've been engaging with them, you know, over the years, but particularly in the past few months, they know what to do, but they don't have the political will to do what they need to do. For instance, they started speaking up about the Emirates and the intervention of the role of the Emirates and so on. And just right after doing that, now there are reports that, well, when at the UN Security Council, the Emirates started boycotting meetings arranged by the UK. So they immediately, you know, went back and started talking to African leaders saying, please do not mention the Emirates intervention. Let's keep this down the low. We're not going to talk about it and so on. So just because the Emirates boycotted their meetings, now they went back on what, you know, the very small step that they took towards acknowledging the Emirates' role in what's happening in Sudan. So having the political will to continue doing what they need to do is one thing that is absolutely missing. Obviously, Russia, like Sudan's gold, is currently being sold to Russia and to the Emirates. When the war is, you know, raging and people are dying, but they are still finding ways to get the gold out. And to show you the contradiction, so the humanitarian aid that is required for Sudan for 2024 is around 2.2 billion. And the Sudanese gold, you know, that is being exported and smuggled rather outside Sudan for 2024 is estimated to go up to 2.4 billion. So more than the humanitarian aid that's required. It's being sold to Russia. It's being sold to the Emirates. Obviously, nothing is going back to the Sudanese state, whatever that is, and going to pockets of specific people and leaders. And I wonder how Sudan's gold, blood gold, is not sanctioned yet, still being allowed to be sold.
I've also seen reports of like Wagner troops in Sudan and in East Africa. Is that an element too?
Even before the war started, we have seen them moving around and so on, supporting the rapid support forces. And Russia's role is quite interesting because they have been supporting both the military and the rapid support forces. And then when the war erupted, they were moving between here and there. And eventually they landed at the Wagner supporting the rapid support forces and the Russia, the state supporting the Sudanese armed forces. And this shows you that, you know, this war has so many dimensions and there's coordination happening at the back doors with people who are fighting in the face of things and so on. But definitely there have been Wagner troops in the country. There have been Ukrainian troops in country as well. So yeah, there's all of that
melting
happening.
Pot of military. Oh gosh, there's so many questions. Okay, let's do one, two. Maybe the gentleman just behind.
Thank you very much. I suppose really on the face of it, the way it's been portrayed is two hellbent generals going at each other, a struggle for resources, power in the region. And when we look at events surrounding that, it's usually how can we mediate between the two powers. I think there needs to be effort made in, you know, not necessarily, I know we're doing that here, but generally speaking, effort should be made in terms of what's driving these two parties to this kind of reality, right? What kind of values is it that underpins their behavior? And I think that's where we need to start to explore, because there is a lot of resources in Sudan. I think you touched upon it earlier in your point. When we explore these values that underpin their behavior, it's generally based on the pursuit for material benefit. And when we ask ourselves, where does this pursuit for material benefit originate from? It originates from the West. It's a fundamental fault in Western capitalism, which is the pursuit for material benefit. And as a result of that, we've seen that by the West and its intervention in many parts of the world, whether it's Iraq, Afghanistan, etc. And the behavior that has been adopted to be able to pursue that material benefit is now a justification for what we see between these two generals in Sudan. So then this begs the question, are those the values that really we should be referring to? And then it then becomes a question, should the West really have legitimacy of in being involved in Sudan, right? Because then that becomes a fundamental question. And then the next question beyond that is, are those institutions associated with West, whether it's the United Nations, whether it's the IMF, whether it's the World Bank, et cetera, are those legitimate institutions? Because they're all fundamentally associated with the specific forces that are driving these kind of violence. And I think what I wanted to ask really is, are we exploring something, shouldn't we be exploring something alternative? I think we should we probably bring the debate to an end and say, enough is enough. We've had the perpetual cycle of Western interference. It's killed too many people. It's a dangerous point of view. Maybe we need to look at something different, a new ideology.
Thank you.
I mean, I think we're way beyond.
Let's take from this lady one, because we've only got a few minutes left.
I think you kind of addressed what I was also. So basically, it's capitalism that is driving from, you know, if the cusp of it. So do these Sudanese generals and like the armed forces, the militia, do they realize they're being used for that material gain? And if they do realize it, where do they draw that line of killing your own people, essentially, for, and these are just innocent civilians who are suffering, and that's who normally suffers, civilians in, you know, in conflict. Where do you draw that line, or where do they draw that line of killing your own civilians if you realize you're being used for capitalistic gains internationally?
I think we're beyond the idea of dealing with this as a sort of moral problem. It's a serious crisis which needs to be stopped completely. And the only way to do that is to cut off resources to these people, to put sanctions, because it's about personal gain. I mean, these people are going on with this. They are earning, they have money outside, you know, Hemeti has huge accounts full of millions of dollars all over the place. Those can be stopped, sanctions can be issued. We're beyond the point, sorry to say, where it's about blaming the West for capitalist values. Capitalist values now are a universal trait. It's all over the world. People want more and they want it now and they don't care how they get it. And if you want to see capitalists, you can see them all over the world today. So it's like, if we want to talk about whether the West is morally to blame or whatever, I don't think that gets us anywhere. We have a serious crisis in hand, and it needs to be nipped in the bud. We're way beyond that now. If the war stopped tomorrow, it would take decades before we get back to where we were a year ago. I don't think Sudan has never seen destruction on this scale. And I mean human deaths, deaths of people, but also material deaths, the infrastructure destruction, you know, the destruction of infrastructure, the collapse of the government. The state is almost gone. There's nothing there. What are you going to do? The markets where people in Omdurman had little market stalls, you know, how are you going to get those people? How is that going to be brought back? You know, it's a huge, huge loss. And counting up the cost of this war is going to take a long time. And these generals have this on their conscience. And somehow they are unable to shift their position. They're unable to move away from it. And that's why there has to be international effort to stop them doing what they're doing. And that has to be immediate, and it has to happen now. Whether it's not working in the Security Council, whether the Emirates don't like it, somebody has to get up and make it happen.
Hamid, do you want to say any last words as we conclude?
Yes, sure. I think I definitely agree with everything that Jamal said. And I think it's way beyond expecting that, you know, the current context in Sudan to be the way we revolt against all these problematic issues that are dominating the world, because the war needs to end now. And probably when we discuss a political process that would reestablish Sudan's, hopefully, transition towards democracy and so on, a lot of these values would be useful. And if you look into the political charters and the visions that have been outlined by the resistance committees, for instance, who are leading the pro-democracy grassroots movement in Sudan and so on, you see a lot of these anti-capitalist, anti-imperialism values and a way of imagining a future in Sudan where we are not subject to these global powers anymore. But that is a luxury that we cannot afford at the moment, because these global powers have money going in, have, you know, leverage that we need to utilize to make the war that ends today. And on the other side, like if you say, looking around the region, the African Union, the Arab League, these are all corrupt institutions. For better or worse, they cannot serve Sudan and cannot serve the region. So that's why unfortunately, we're stuck in this situation where we have to rely on these powers. The last thing that I would say, I think, is it's important that we keep talking about Sudan. It's not in the media, it's not anywhere, and I don't think it's forgotten because people are speaking about it, but it's being deliberately and intentionally, you know, taken out of the news because it's not a priority, but also because it's not interesting enough. So I think collectively we have a responsibility to keep talking about Sudan.
That's a good point to end. Thank you, Hamid. Thank you, Jamal. I think you're both going to be outside so you can continue the conversation. But thank you for coming, and yeah.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival on Friday the 27th of June to Sunday the 6th of July 2025.